Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. My guest today is Steve Greenfield, and he's here to talk about what happened in 1968 and the civil unrest that's going on now. So, Steve, how would you compare 1968 to now?
Well, I'm still going to go with 1968 was a worse time in this country than it is now. And, you know, for those of anyone listening out there who wasn't alive yet in 1968 or was alive but was too young to be aware of what was going on, let me just run through a couple of quick things about 1968 so that people can keep some perspective. Although I'm going to say, we're getting a little closer. We're getting a little bit closer. And that's part of what we're going to be talking about today. 1968 started out in January with a major surprise attack by the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong and the anti-American forces in South Vietnam. That was a tremendous success and demonstrated a change from guerrilla tactics to organized warfare. That by the following month, by February, had this famous incident in the news of Walter Cronkite effectively declaring that the United States should withdraw. The principal, most trusted anchor man in the entire journalism business, went on television and told the country that the war would have to be settled through negotiation and an American withdrawal. That was immediately followed by Lyndon Johnson, the president at the time, who was expected to win election easily, announcing he was no longer running and was leaving the race. That was immediately followed by Dr. Martin Luther King being assassinated. And that was immediately followed by substantial rioting and burning all over the country, in major cities, small cities, the entire country in the aftermath of the King assassination. Two anti-war candidates in the Democratic Party were performing particularly well. They were at the front of the primary voting results, which were Eugene McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy. But of course, in June, right after the California primary that Bobby Kennedy won, at the party after that primary, he was assassinated and shot on that day. By a month after that, the convention, the Democratic convention, was happening in Chicago, at which time a lot of anti-war protesters turned out in the park and the streets outside the convention center. And of course, the Democratic Party mayor of Chicago, William Daley, unleashed his police force to really beat and riot on everybody that had turned out. That was the famous "the whole world is watching" chant while the police were outside the convention center and in Grant Park, rioting and beating everybody in sight mercilessly. And then that was followed by the nomination of a candidate that had not even been running. So basically the Democratic Party set aside the primaries in their entirety and nominated Hubert Humphrey, who hadn't even been running in the primaries. And then fast forward to the end of 1968, where Richard Nixon got elected president, because in between, after the Democratic convention, George Wallace, who was a governor of Alabama and represented the racist and Klan elements of the South in the traditional Democratic Party from back before the Civil War, decided to run an independent candidate, and he won the Confederate states. This is a rare instance of a third party candidate actually winning electoral votes by winning entire states, and that was 1968. Okay, it was really bad. You know, we're in Vietnam, we're having major assassinations, we're having riots and burnings, et cetera and so forth, right? And so I have been saying ever since Trump got elected that, you know, people need to keep some perspective and remember that for many of us, even in our own lifetimes, we have already been through much worse. Now,
okay,
that
let me stop you right there. And I hate to throw cold water on you, but you said William Daley. It was Richard Daley.
Richard Daley. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm speaking quickly. Richard Daley, and then his son became mayor some years later, right? As he's,
right.
You know, eventually Richard Daley Jr. became. They have
right,
quite a dynasty.
Right.
The kind of politics, the machine politics in Chicago. Richard Daley, right? You're right. I apologize for that. But bringing it back to what I said at the beginning,
I didn't finish my thought. You know, You talk about how bad it was in 68, and you're going into right now. And I wanna say something about right now. It's scary. We're in the midst of a pandemic. We're in the midst of people all over the country demonstrating and rioting. We have a president that's so out of touch. He's an absolute buffoon. And we have a Democratic candidate who is just as out of touch as might be even more dangerous. So I've got to say, this is really a difficult time to be living in America.
Well, I'm not disagreeing with you on that. That's why I started before I ran down 1968 a little bit for people who weren't around for it, that I do believe
okay.
Now we're now getting close. We are approaching. We are in a really bad state. And obviously the pandemic is something that we have no precedent for in our history. What this means in terms of, you know, how we can be out asserting our democratic rights, how we can be protecting ourselves from, police brutality, how we can, and you're right, okay, to the election this year is in at least as much disarray as the election back in 1968. And, you know, in part due to some very similar dynamics that represent kind of the distinctions between progressivism and capitalism and right-wing social liberal Democratic Party politics, is that just like now, the DNC, rather than allowing the people that belong to the Democratic Party to express themselves through a primary process and pick their own candidate as the members of the party, they issued a directed selection that they chose because they hoped it somehow created some kind of nuanced coalition between the civil rights faction of the white liberal Democratic Party, which was more a social liberal faction, and the anti-war faction, which was which had put together, and it's important to remember this, that the anti-war vote in that primary was split. It was split between Gene McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy. And when you added their two vote totals together, you ended up with a considerable majority of primary voters that had voted for the anti-war candidates. And in the same kind of choice that the DNC made this year, they kind of decided, well, if we find somebody that can create some kind of blend of the different parts of our tent, even though he's not a particularly popular figure overall, that everyone will just kind of coalesce and unite and will be able to win this election without ever really having to explain to the public what winning the election would mean. Like, would it mean the war would be ended? We don't know. Would it mean these various social justice and anti-poverty things would continue and environmental? Oh, we don't know. We just know that we sort of got somebody who's somewhere in the middle and has some appeal to certain elements of several different groups, and the rest of you are just going to get behind it. Interesting difference then than now, though, is that, the right wing split away. They didn't stick with the coalition. It was the right wing and the racists who said, no, we're not going with this. The left wing and the anti-war people actually did a pretty good job of coalescing together to try to stop the election of Richard Nixon. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, Donald Trump is a wild man. He's absolutely insane, has the mentality of a four-year-old and the egocentric nature of a four-year-old, and no background to actually preside over this country and over our allies and trading partners around the world. We know that. But on the other hand, 1968 and Richard Nixon represented Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger and a group of people who were going to come in who would go on to kill 3 million people. And when Richard Nixon was president, that's when Kent State happened. That's when Jackson State happened, right? That it was the Nixon administration was the heyday of people firing on protesters and killing them. We did a show on this, you know, a few weeks ago. And that's an important thing to remember, too, because everybody's upset that Donald Trump is saying a lot of inflammatory things about forceful state response to these protests. And I think we need to treat that as seriously as a heart attack. I do think that we need to acknowledge that we should consider Donald Trump capable of getting that to happen. But we also need to remember, just again, to look back at 1968, that the president that won in 1968 went on to, like, bomb, you know, major parts of the world, kill millions of people, and order law enforcement and, you know, to start shooting down protesters in the street, right? We had this happen. And that was by somebody that liberals today would call a reasonable Republican, right? Everyone is treating Donald Trump as if he's an existential threat, that this is a presidency unlike anything America has ever seen. It's uniquely dangerous, and that's why nobody's allowed to put demands on Biden, because we're in a uniquely existentially dangerous situation. And the fact of the matter is that Richard Nixon, who, by the way, formed the Environmental Protection Administration and de-escalated the Cold War and did all kinds of interesting things that your normal moderate – he started the HMO Act, right? He made it – I disagree with that act, but it was the first kind of public health insurance program that incentivized employers, the system we have now, right, an employment-based system to provide health insurance. Nixon did all of that. He was a so-called moderate Republican with moderate and experienced advisors, and yet he did things so many times worse than anything that the people who are treating Donald Trump like an existential threat can point to and suggest that would happen under Donald Trump. So, again, you have to forgive me as someone in my late 50s who looks back at just the arc of my own lifetime, let alone the entire history of the United States, and see a dangerous person, but not someone who is uniquely dangerous, not someone who can be used to paint us in a way that they did back in 1968 of saying we have to accept anything from their nominating process because we're under an existential threat. We are under a terrible and dangerous threat, and Donald Trump is a madman. But it's not new in our history. You and I both lived through this in the transition from 1968 to 1969. And on top of it, we have some failures of the Fourth Estate and of our general organizing in this country, in that back in 1968, the press was covering the war. The war was on television every single night and the news every night. And we've been at war since September of 2001, and we have – and that was, by the way, they had only 30 minutes a day, right? Cronkite was on only half an hour a day and the three networks, and they still managed to cover the war every single day. And now we've got multiple 24-hour, quote-unquote, news networks, and we've been at war since September of 2001, and none of these networks devotes 30 seconds to these wars. So, you know, the people are not involved with this in any way, and many other critical news items. We don't have a civil rights movement, right? There was an organized civil rights movement, not just under the Southern Christian Leadership Council and Dr. King, but also SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. There were other more militant groups. The Panthers were out there. There were hierarchical systems by which the disadvantaged and disenfranchised. If Martin Luther King had just started putting together the Poor People's Campaign, we had an active anti-poverty movement. Now we're in kind of a weird situation where terrible things are happening, but it's been decades since we had any kind of structure within a democratic system and institutions built to react and confront and resist these various things that are happening right now. So that, too, is a little bit more dangerous, right? Because without that kind of institutional channels that were so active in the late 1960s, we have no way of knowing who's going to do what, who's answering to who, who's a person that can calm things down, who's a person that can bring about resistance, who's a person that, you know, none of that exists today. So that's another change, another big change. That's, again, like with the COVID, that too is a wild card that makes it impossible for us to draw direct comparisons between 68 and today. But on the other hand, as I said at the beginning, I don't want you to think that there's a diminishment of what's happening right now. Quite the contrary. I am now freely admitting that we are now in a situation that I think we can reasonably compare to how bad things were in 1968, so that we could think in terms of, you know, is this a significant transition point for us as people, where we once again react in a way that we're no longer going to just quietly take orders from the establishment. We're not going to vote when you say vote. We're not going to say get up on the sidewalk. We're not going to get up on the sidewalk if you say get up on the sidewalk. You know, and that we're going to look at this as people, as citizens, and not as people who are loyal to a partisan election system. If we can start regaining the consciousness that we had back in those times as a result of how terrible they were, that made us think independently as citizens and instead of just as people who obey the institutions that we traditionally rely upon to explain things to us and to tell us what they need us to do in response to those explanations. So we are now, you know, I'm going to lay it right on the line. We're officially in a bad time. There's another wild card for us right now that's connected to COVID that was not in place in 1968. In 1968, the economy was very strong. And 3 years earlier, in 1965, the principal anti-poverty programs and healthcare programs of Medicare, Medicaid, public assistance had all come about in 65. And so there was a social safety net for people that were living in poverty that sort of placated things. You know, now we have 40 million people unemployed. We have a 16% unemployment rate. You know, and no way for people to feel encouraged that they're going to have a roof over their head and food on the table going forward from here. So there's another key difference that argues that perhaps we're heading into something that could turn worse than 1968 was. You know, there's a lot happening. So there we are. Now, what's happening in the country right now is that, of course, we've seen a series of acts of murder and intended brutality against black people by the police, by citizens seeking to invoke the police to commit acts of violence, like we saw in Central Park in New York, and several murders. Let's just call them what they are: several flat-out murders of African Americans by police. And so, you know, that comes out, you know, now in real time. We don't need to wait for the 7 o'clock news to come on. We've got the internet, we've got live streaming. We see this stuff now, and people end up as they have been in the past, like the Rodney King beating in Los Angeles 30 years ago. You know, these things happen and they get filmed and they get in front of people and the reaction is severe. There was another one in the 80s everyone's forgotten about that was in Miami when some kid was shot off the back of a motorcycle in Liberty City, Miami, and caused major riots in the aftermath of that. And so that's what's happening right now is, you know, the establishment's veneer has been pulled back, right? Minneapolis, like Miami, like Los Angeles, Minneapolis is a Democrat town, right? St. Paul across the river has a black mayor, a Democrat. These are Baltimore with Freddie Gray that we saw a few years ago, right? Has had a black mayor and all Democrats running the city council. You know, so the veneer of the establishment of the people believing that they can get us all to continue to believe that there's clear-cut choices between blue and red and that, you know, things are fine if we elect Democrats. Obviously, things are not fine if we elect Democrats, right? Obviously, you know, these incidents are not tending to happen in Republican towns in red states. These things are happening in big liberal blue controlled cities. And so that is what's kind of coming into people's minds right now. And that's what we're seeing the Democratic Party struggling to control, because all of this happened while this was developing. Joe Biden was on television, you know, telling people his personal standard of how they should be black, you know. And I don't just mean the one statement right. that he made at the end. I mean the entire interview where he was lying about the effects of his crime bill, and everything else that he was doing during that interview, that there was already a certain burst, a sudden burst of racial awareness, that there's some major problems in the race-oriented social justice program of the Democratic Party and their mealy-mouthed standard bearer, that in trying to appeal to everyone, they picked somebody that appeals to no one. and that this was just coming out as a public complaint when the murder in Minneapolis happened. And so what have you got? You've got Biden. He won't even go so far as to announce that he's going to stop considering Amy Klobuchar as a vice presidential candidate. There's been suddenly today, finally, a little bit of talk among the press. Amy Klobuchar, you know, was a prosecutor there, and she received complaints about this particular cop that was the person who physically murdered, George Floyd. And even though he's got like seven different people to consider for vice president, some of whom are very popular, he won't even come right out and say, due to Amy Klobuchar's connection to this cop in her former career as a prosecutor, I'm removing her from the list. Amy Klobuchar herself hasn't stepped forward and said, in the interest of helping this election, I'm withdrawing my name for consideration. We can't even get them to make a statement like that, even though it cost them nothing, is also weighing very heavily on the problem right now. So all of that having been said, all of that framework, I went down yesterday. These are happening all over the country. And because I have friends, I'm from the city and I have friends, I used to live uptown. I went to a rally that was being held in front of the state office buildings at Adam Clayton Powell Jr. Boulevard and 125th Street, right in the heart of Harlem, upper Manhattan, yesterday, basically to bear witness, to show support to my friends, and to bear witness to events, because right, there's a lot we're seeing on the media, you know, about are people being violent? Is that appropriate? Is the violence actually caused by white outside agitators that are showing up from other places, and it's not the African-American protesters themselves that are doing this? All these conversations are arising. I certainly saw on video some police brutality in Brooklyn the night before, and so I decided I would put together some protective gear for myself involving face shields and helmets and of course, breathing masks, eye protection as a precaution, and head down there and just bear witness for myself about what's happening. And I have to say that I did witness something that I've suspected from coverage that I've seen in other places. I witnessed it really from the start of the rally, which is that there exists right now a very stark divide between traditional black Democrat leadership that purports to speak to the black population and keep them contained, and doing exactly what the Democratic Party wants them to do, and the sentiment out on the street, the sentiment of the people who are feeling these raw emotions that are out there on the street. The rally I went to actually opened up, and I was flabbergasted, right? As a late middle-aged white man, I could not believe what I was seeing when the microphones were turned on. Someone came up, and the first thing he said, literally the first words out of his mouth, was calling over to people. There was an overflow crowd. Adam Clayton Powell Boulevard is a very large road with a good 30-foot island in the middle of it, you know, pavement and grass and stuff. It's a boulevard. And there were a lot of people standing there in the island, in the street, not on the, on all the way across in front of the state office building on the plaza. And so it started out with the first speaker making an announcement that he wanted everybody to leave the island and come on over and assemble with everyone else on the plaza because the police didn't want people standing on the island. And the booing started immediately. And then he followed it up by saying, well, it's better that you come over here voluntarily, because if you stay out there standing on the island, the police are just going to come over and make you leave. And then the booing got even louder. Because the island is actually, it's legal to stand there. It's this giant piece of land in between the traffic lanes, and there are benches in it. And, you know, it's not an illegal place to stand, but I couldn't believe my ears that this, you know, this rally was being opened with an announcement that, you know, we want you to do this because the police told us. You know, how do you hold a rally against police brutality while people's emotions are so raw, and the police were beating people up in Brooklyn the night before, and everyone saw the video of that, and then open up your rally by saying, you know, the police want us to do this, so we're going to do it. So, you know, soon enough, a lot of yelling and chanting began to have this man give up the microphone. And he didn't, but eventually he finished what he was saying, which I couldn't hear because everyone was booing and yelling. And then he passed it over to a woman who started talking about the importance of voting. Again, in a 90% Democrat city, in a state that's electoral vote is going to go blue, you know, by over 1.5 million votes. And the booing got even louder because, again, there's nothing wrong with telling people to vote, but was this the place? Like, was this the spot when you need to kind of get the crowd and you want to get their attention and hold them for the rest of what you're doing with your rally? If your first message is about cooperating with the police and then your second message is about the importance of voting in a city where all the votes go to the party that the liberals want the votes going to anyway. So the booing got even louder, and then everybody just split. Everybody that was up there went and marched away, and marched down to Adam Clayton Powell Boulevard, right into the middle of the street, closed down the whole street. I went with them because, like I said, I was there to observe. Ultimately, they headed down as far as 111th Street. They walked 14 blocks southbound, made an eastward turn. For a while, the police were doing nothing, but they finally caught up with the march 2 miles away at about 111th Street and 1st Avenue, where they tried to engineer a mass arrest, which I really don't know why they were doing that, because they could have just had everybody get up on the sidewalks. But instead, they closed off the sidewalks with bicycles and riot police, and were trying to sort of channel people into a mass arrest situation. And so the people not being interested in that marched off instead to the east and ended up closing down the FDR Drive, the major six-lane highway around Manhattan, you know, and that ended up happening because of a police miscalculation. You know, and this is kind of the problem, which is that because we haven't had any kind of institutions and organizations asserting these kinds of activities in the recent past, the police also have no capacity to respond to civil unrest situations. And that's why we're seeing the brutality that we're seeing, the rubber bullets, the tear gas, you know, the mass violence and the mass arrests. And for anybody who's complaining that there are some people who they feel, you know, should be thinking more clearly about behaving violently, I would just say to those people, you know, you're not there. You're watching this on video. You're not breathing in the tear gas. You're not getting hit by the rubber bullets. You're not being channeled into mass arrest when you should be at liberty to get on the sidewalk and not break the law. You know, who would believe that those people weren't breaking the law on purpose? They wanted to get on the sidewalk, but the police were blocking the sidewalk because the police wanted a mass arrest. So, you know, that's what I, yeah.
Our time is up.
Our time is up. We're going to have to do a part two.
Okay, we'll do a part two. But tell everybody about your congressional run.
19th District, New York, Hudson Valley. It runs from Ulster and Dutchess County and Sullivan County to the southern end up to Columbia and Greene counties on both sides of the river. I'm running as a Green Party candidate. I'm running against a straight Wall Street Democrat who's the incumbent, freshman incumbent, a Republican to be named later because they have two people trying to duke it out for the primary. And I am running on a platform of peace, of reconciliation, of a resilient economy, of health care for all, of anti-Wall Street, anti-war, pro-environment. You can look up my website, stevegreenfieldsforcongress.com, and send me a message at greenfieldsforcongress@gmail.com. I answer all questions personally, so I invite people to talk to me and get in touch, and I challenge Antonio Delgado to a series of debates, not general two-minute answer debates, but topic debates. We can do a series of topic debates on all of these issues so that we can truly get a chance for the first time to let the public understand what the issues are about, how our presentations about them differ, so that they can finally cast an informed vote.
And I also invite Antonio Delgado to come on All Exits Closed and talk about the racial problems that are going on in this country now. So this is All Exits Closed, and you've been listening to Steve Greenfield. And if you like this show, follow us on Twitter. Steve, thank you, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.
Thank you.